Welcome to the Smichael Speaks podcast. This is the space and the place for leadership learning. I'm Joanne Smichael. I'm a speaker, an educator, a consultant, and a forever student of the world. Enjoy this episode. It's an honor to have Dr. Will Manti as my guest this morning on the Brain Matters series. Dr. Manti has earned an international reputation as a researcher in causes of progressive cognitive or behavioral loss, including dementia with Lewy bodies, vascular dementia, frontotemporal dementia, and other rare types of dementing illnesses. He's an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota. I almost gave him a promotion to associate professor.
Did just get promoted, so you're Yes.
Congratulations. I'm glad to hear that. So we got new news here. He is now an associate professor at the University of Minnesota. He's a clinician, a researcher, and he's committed to finding cures for dementia. Welcome, Will Manti.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here today.
So I want to talk a little bit about your preparation for the work that you're doing. I know you went to med school at the University of Minnesota. I know you did fellowships at Mayo, at the Mayo Clinic, and an undergrad in economics from the University of Chicago. Most obvious question, how did somebody with an undergrad in economics wind up in med school and then get completely immersed in dementia research and treatments?
Yeah, I'm kind of still wondering how that all happened myself. I'll start here though. I knew I did not want to go into medicine when I was, in middle school and high school. And the reason is that my mom was a neurologist, and I would hear her phone ringing at night. Basically a couple times, almost every other night, her phone would be going off, and I'd say, "Mom, what are you doing?" I'd say, "Well, you know, the hospital's calling. There's sick people." And I said, "You know, this is definitely not a job that I want to go into. I'm the type of person who really enjoys his sleep. And so I thought this was definitely not the career that I'm going to go into. So I almost avoided medicine, actually. After I was done with my economics degree at University of Chicago, I decided to work with a NGO in rural Ecuador. And our job was to sort of quantify the costs of just going to a hospital for rural populations. And the idea was that in Ecuador, just like a lot of other countries, even in the United States, a lot of rural populations don't have a nearby hospital. And so they would travel many hours, spend quite a bit of money on hotel, money on new clothes, because, you know, Ecuador, it's a small country, but there's massive altitude variation. So you could go from kind of rural highlands to very hot lowlands. And then, of course, food and transportation costs. And sometimes it could be devastating. It could be something that would take someone's entire yearly income to get to the more urban-based hospital. And this work involved a lot of interaction with doctors and nurses and interviewing participants. And I basically just loved the work I was doing. I especially loved working in a clinic setting where we did a lot of our interviews. And I basically thought, you know what, I really do actually want to go into healthcare. And had this epiphany there. So that really kind of got the ball rolling. And I was super lucky to be able to do my post-bac classes to catch up on medical school prerequisite courses, get accepted to my home state, University of Minnesota. And the rest is history, basically. So, it was that kind of transformative experience, I would say, in Ecuador that kind of got me on track to go into a career in medicine.
So that means you're bilingual.
So I do speak Spanish, I would say, conversationally. I'm someone who, you know, especially now that I haven't been practicing as much, may have a little bit of trouble with some of the more sophisticated words. I did have the ability to go to a French immersion school when I was younger. So I went to French immersion until fifth grade. So that, I think, you know, it was very nice because when you learn a Latin, romantic language, you have that basis for learning other, romance languages down the line. So Spanish, I think, came a little bit easier, but I would say this much, it's funny how when you're forced to do something, you do it so much faster. So when I was in Ecuador, I spoke very little Spanish, and I said, you know what? Either I learn Spanish and I'm gonna have friends and be able to go out and enjoy myself, or I don't, and I basically don't have much of an interaction with people. And it's funny, like that necessity really pushed me to study and to like really listen to people, like really listen, but like, hey, what exactly are they saying? And kind of I think accelerated the learning process. Yeah.
That's a very interesting dimension to your life. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So why dementia? Why did you choose to direct so much of your life's energy to dementia? What was the compelling factor? Like, why did you do this?
Yeah. So I think two main reasons. One is I feel like dementia and the sort of what sometimes is called the higher order cognition, you know, memory and visual spatial skills and you know, how we prioritize things and manipulate things off the top of our head. You know, we still understand extremely little at the end of the day of how that all happens. And so I felt like it was sort of a exciting kind of frontier area for me of discovering something new, and thinking about how that might all work. But I think the most important part for me was that I felt like I was, it's the type of field where you're forced to have as much of a human interaction as possible in a medical setting. And what I mean by that is when we're trying to figure out what the cause of someone's cognitive decline is, we really have to get to know who they are. I always ask people what their occupation is because it gives you a sense of what they might be good at or what they might be bad at. You have to know if they've had any head trauma history, whether they around the time that they were born, you know, whether there was any potential deprivation of oxygen that could lead them to have some kind of long-term brain damage, you know, whether they had any strokes, whether they grew up in a household with intellectual enrichment, whether they had a affordable I'm sorry, whether they were afforded educational opportunities in life, or whether they may not have had kind of a scholastic educational background, which would affect how they do on testing, whether they had any addictions and substance use. You kind of need to cover the gambit of someone's entire life. And I think that was the main reason that I wanted to go into medicine, because I felt like you were given this privilege to be able to get to know someone and really connect with them. And I think this is a field where you really need to do that to do your job well. And so you can't have the sort of rushed experience that I think a lot of specialties unfortunately have, you know, where you kind of go through a rapid checklist of, you know, do you have this symptom or not? Okay, next question, do you have this symptom or not? Okay, now we're done with, you know, that checklist, and here's the next set of tests you're getting. And then at the end of a 15-minute visit, you know, you're out of the door and you really never got to know who the person was. You know, I think unfortunately a lot of medicine, you know, has become a little bit dehumanizing for physicians and patients. And I think this is a field where, sure, you know, we still have the problems that the rest of medicine has, but I think there is, generally speaking, relative benefit of having longer visits where you really get to know who someone is and what their history is, so you can you know, put together the most accurate assessment of why they're having cognitive issues.
You know, we hear the word dementia a lot now. When I was growing up, we used to say that old people were senile. Or a friend reminded me that we used to say that, you know, they're just old and crazy. You know, everybody's got an old crazy aunt or an old senile aunt. What is dementia? Because it's not crazy and it's not senile. Can you provide a little education on what it is?
Yeah, and this is a confusing term because doctors even used these terms sort of, which I say interchangeably, for quite a long time. And I would say it's only kind of in the 90s and early 2000s that we as a medical field really moved to try to emphasize that, you know, there's such a thing as healthy aging, you know, where you, yes, you get older and certain things generally are more difficult. But then there's something called dementia where, you start to lose the ability to do things that were previously second nature and relatively easy because of a cognitive issue. So dementia is a pathological or is not a normal part of the aging process where someone now needs help getting through their day-to-day life because of a cognitive issue. So yeah, it's different than just getting older and let's say having a senior moment where you walk into a room and let's you don't remember why you went into the room. I actually have that happen to me quite frequently. Maybe I just turned 40, so maybe I'm starting to, realize what that feels like. Or forgetting the name of like who Elvis was, maybe not forgetting who he was, but forgetting what the, kind of not finding the word Elvis or the word of, someone's favorite song. That is, those are common things that happen as we get older. But once someone, let's say who's very good at, here's an example, I had a patient recently who's a very good woodworker and was very good at measuring precisely the dimensions that he needed to build his the tables he generally constructed. And then he couldn't figure out how to measure things anymore. He couldn't put them together. He just couldn't, the numbers weren't making sense to him anymore. How numbers related to each other didn't make a sense for him anymore. And that, is something that, again, was very easy for him in the past and now is very difficult and was definitely a red flag that, yes, this could be the symptom of an emerging neurodegenerative disease or a dementia. So yeah, we do separate them out in terms of, this is now something that's pathological versus something that could be, again, I use the word senior moment, but things that happen to us as we get older that aren't considered pathological.
I'm curious. I know now, I didn't know until I started with the American Brain Foundation. I know now that there are a lot of different types of dementia. Can you tell which one? And I know people say Alzheimer's and think that that covers all dementia, but I now know that that's not true. Can you tell us what are the most common types and how they're similar and different from one another?
So there's several broad categories of dementia. And I will get into the weeds a little bit here because there's sort of been a shift in how we think about dementia from, which I say, a neurologist's standpoint. So on one hand, there is the protein that's accumulating in the brain, that is more or less responsible, and there's obviously some nuance there where the protein may not be entirely the culprit. There may be alternative things we're not currently detecting, but each dementia is sort of defined by the abnormal protein accumulating in the brain. So Alzheimer's disease, just to give you an example, is defined by the abnormal accumulation of amyloid beta and hyperphosphorylated tau. Another dementia called dementia Lewy bodies, that's caused by an underlying pathology that's termed Lewy body disease. And that's composed of alpha-synuclein proteins that aggregate into what's seen under the microscope as Lewy bodies. There's a whole bunch of other ones too. There's one called TDP43. There's one called four repeat tauopathy and three repeat tauopathy. And these are kind of an alphabet soup of different, acronyms and letters and numbers. But the important part is that each dementia is defined by the abnormal protein that accumulates in the brain. Alzheimer's disease, just to give an example, has, generally speaking, a memory predominant disorder, and causes someone to lose track of, what happened yesterday or where they went to eat or what they ate for breakfast. However, Alzheimer's disease can also cause non-memory problems. Some people present with a purely visual spatial issue. Some people present with a pure language issue. In very rare cases, people can present with behavioral and sort of impulsive type of issue. And this is where it gets confusing because when we use the term Alzheimer's disease, we used to refer to someone who's has dementia and has memory trouble. But now, when we say the word Alzheimer's disease, what we're really referring to is the underlying proteins, the amyloid beta plaques and the hyperphosphorylated tau tangles. And so now we when we define what someone or I'm sorry, when we define what someone's diagnosis is, we refer to what the predicted underlying proteins are, such as Alzheimer's disease, and then we also specify what symptoms they're causing. So we'd say, let's say memory disorder due to Alzheimer's disease or visual spatial disorder due to Alzheimer's disease. And then what stage of disease they're in, whether they're in, let's say, a very mild stage, like mild cognitive impairment, or whether they're in a severe dementia stage. So we might say, memory disorder due to Alzheimer's disease in the mild cognitive impairment stage. So it's gotten a little bit trickier because with our greater understanding of the science behind it, we know that these proteins, even though they might have kind of a signature type of problem that causes the brain, it can really involve almost any brain region and can cause a really diverse array of different symptoms. So when we describe a disease that's a neurodegenerative disease, we always talk about what we think the underlying protein is, and then how it's actually manifesting and how it's affecting the brain. So that was kind of what should I say, a long response to your relatively straightforward question. But yeah, so that's kind of a general overview of at least some of the main types of dementia out there.
That raises another question. And go as long as you want because it's interesting. So, do you do blood work? What do you do to diagnose these different dementias? Like, how do you know?
So the nice part is that we do have new blood tests for at least Alzheimer's disease. And those blood tests are super accurate. In fact, a lot of recent publications have suggested that they're just as accurate as doing a spinal tap and removing cerebral spinal fluid. So really exciting stuff. One thing that I always tell people though is that those blood tests, they can detect the proteins associated with Alzheimer's disease, but they can't really tell you what stage of disease that person is in. So these neurodegenerative diseases, one characteristic is that the proteins accumulate over many, many years, decades even. So there's a long period where the patient has no idea that they have these proteins accumulating. And again, it's only after decades that they start manifesting symptoms. When it comes to diagnosing someone, you can't just get a blood test and be done, because you could get a blood test, let's say that's positive, and that person might be a decade away from developing Alzheimer's, but may have an alternative cause of why they have memory issues. Like maybe they have sleep apnea that's untreated. You know, if you just got a blood test and didn't ask them any other questions, you could falsely conclude that their memory issue is due to Alzheimer's disease and not due to the sleep apnea you didn't ask about. Which brings me to the general theme of what do we do in our office then? What's our general workup, like you asked? So the general workup does involve a very extensive set of questions, like I was discussing in terms of why I went into this field, because you really have to go from A to Z in terms of different reasons that the person could have their memory issues. So first of all, we always get a general sense of what the memory issue is, and we ask open-ended questions. We also make sure that we cover things like how someone is sleeping. Sleep is so important to our cognition, that and the rates of sleep disorders are so high. We almost always need to ask about that. We always ask about someone's general health. You know, if someone, let's say, is suffering from a cancer and is on chemotherapy, that's of course going to affect how they're doing from a memory standpoint. So we cover a diverse array of general health issues. We always ask about medications. You know, a lot of people are on over-the-counter, let's say, allergy pills every day. I had a patient who was taking Benadryl every day because of allergies, whether their allergies were in season or not, and was having some subtle memory issues. And I basically said, hey, we should try taking this off because this could be the culprit of why you have memory issues. And sure enough, you know, taking her off Benadryl restored her memory back to what she was used to. And then we generally ask about family history. If someone has a first degree relative with dementia, that does increase their chances of developing dementia. We always ask about substance use. We ask about someone's early development, you know, whether they had any issues around the time of their birth, whether they had anything like, let's say, ADHD that might kind of impact on how they do on their tests and how their memory is in general. We always ask about head trauma. People who've had a history of head trauma generally can have a higher risk for developing dementia in the future. We do a neurological exam to see if there's any features on how their muscles move that could tip us into whether they could have, let's say, Parkinson's disease. We know that people with Parkinson's disease have cognitive issues with that. And we almost always get neuroimaging. So we almost always get an MRI scan of the brain to see what the brain looks like and see if they've had a stroke or see if they have, God forbid, a brain tumor or other brain pathologies that could be causing the memory disorder. And then if we look at the picture and we say, you know what, this could be Alzheimer's disease, At that point, we do testing, like the one we talked about with a blood test. We can also get the more old school tests, like the cerebral spinal fluid test, or what's called a PET scan, PET. That's a way of actually looking at the brain to see if it has the amyloid or the tau protein there. Yeah, so that's sort of our general diagnostic workup, without going into too much detail. There's some additional tests coming out for non-Alzheimer's disease. So there's, for instance, a new cerebral spinal fluid test for alpha-synuclein, which is the protein responsible for dementia with Lewy bodies and Parkinson's disease, that's available. There's new proteins that are being discovered that can test for those other more rare types of neurodegenerative diseases, like the frontotemporal dementias, let's say. So yeah, we're at a very exciting time in our ability to actually detect those abnormal proteins that cause these neurodegenerative diseases. Because ultimately, if it was just me sitting in the room with a patient and talking to them, we're actually not super accurate. Even with an MRI scan and diagnosing Alzheimer's disease, we're generally wrong about 30 to 20% of the time.
Wow.
So that's why these new blood tests and these new tests that can actually look at the abnormal underlying protein are so helpful, especially as we enter these, especially as we enter this new era of therapies that go after the protein that you think the patient has. You really want to make sure that you know what you're doing and that you've confirmed that the patient has the disease you think they have before you give them these types of therapies. So yeah, it's an exciting time where we're better able to diagnose patients.
That is very heartening. That is very heartening. Now, you're a cognitive neurologist. Do you work with other specialties to treat patients?
Definitely, yeah. So just in our diagnostic workup piece, we certainly work with neuroradiology. I mentioned, getting an MRI scan and really needing a neuroradiologist to account for all the brain problems that could be appearing on their MRI scan that could be contributing to their cognitive impairment. We have neuropsychologists. These are people who administer, let's say, a 2 to 3 hour battery of cognitive tests. That can be helpful because one, it can tell if someone who comes in your office and you think, you know what, this person probably is just having normal aging. They're just having a couple, moments here and there that aren't really too concerning. But you know what, maybe it is a little bit concerning because they lost their job and that's a little bit more than I'd expect. And so neuropsychologists can test someone very extensively to see how they match up against the general population. And they can pick up more subtle declines than we can in our office where we're limited to, a more basic kind of 5 to 10 minute kind of screening test. So neuropsychology is very important too. One specialty that I think is under, maybe not under recognized, but we'll just say they're extremely important is primary care. So a lot, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, a little bit more in our discussion today, but dementia risk factors, you really want to take care of those in early and midlife. Things like high cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, those things can lead to wear and tear of the 400 miles of blood vessels in your brain. And those blood vessels are very, very tiny, and they're susceptible to the wear and tear of those heart conditions. So you really want to make sure that a patient has well-controlled blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, and really any other chronic diseases because your brain will feel it at the end of the day. And so I think it's super important that we work with our primary care colleagues and that we do everything we can, not only to reduce the risk factors for people who have yet to develop future dementia, but even in people with dementia, we know that, let's say, if you have poorly controlled blood pressure and you have Alzheimer's disease, you're going to decline at a much faster rate than if you had well-controlled blood pressure. So that's why working with our primary care colleagues is super important because we want to optimize everything we can in the person's general health so that we can assure that they decline at the slowest rate and that they have the best preservation of the years that they're independent and able to have quality of life.
Okay, this isn't on our list of things that I put down to talk about, but I have a curiosity question. Why is it, or how is it, that Alzheimer's kills? Like, why, what is it that it does? Because if it's in the brain, why is it that it kills people?
No, I actually was wondering the same thing for quite a while in my medical training, and I have this discussion not infrequently with my patients, even though it's sort of a morbid discussion. But yeah, it's something that people want to know. So I kind of tell the story this way. Alzheimer's disease, you're right, is a cognitive disorder for the grand majority of its course. But in the later stages of Alzheimer's disease, it actually affects your muscles. So people have difficulty moving their muscles, and that includes your swallowing. And we always subconsciously swallow throughout the day. You know, we do it without realizing it. And what happens is that people, when they subconsciously swallow, their swallowing musculature doesn't work well enough, and the saliva will go down into the lungs. It'll go into the trachea, into the windpipe, and down to the lungs, as opposed to down to the stomach. And the bacteria in your mouth are extremely aggressive, and they can cause a rip-roaring pneumonia. And so people with Alzheimer's disease generally pass away when they're in that severe disease stage and their muscles are no longer working, and they develop a pneumonia, a very aggressive pneumonia, and they pass away. Alternatively, and this is sort of a similar process, people stop eating. People lose kind of a desire, should I say, a drive to eat, or they may have difficulty swallowing, but they basically can no longer sustain themselves nutritionally, and they pass away from lack of nutrition. I do see some patients too who you know, have a terrible fall. We know that patients with Alzheimer's disease are at much higher risk for falls, especially in the later disease stages when your muscles start to be involved, and will have a catastrophic fall, and may hit their head and pass away from complications related to that. But yeah, you're right though. You can't pass away from just having, you know, extremely bad memory. You know, it's really when it starts affecting, you know, the muscles that allow us to keep our nutrition in and allow us to, you know, keep upright in that fall, basically.
So, what's going on with treatment? What are some of the emerging or the evolving treatments? And thank you for letting me go off on that
No, that's great.
tandem there. Yeah, thank you.
So treatment. Yeah, this is another very exciting area. I think I'll start with sort of the newer stuff first and then work my way backwards.
Okay.
There are new drugs now for Alzheimer's disease. As I mentioned earlier, the proteins responsible for Alzheimer's disease are what we're targeting. So these new drugs are going after the amyloid beta plaques, or the amyloid plaques in the brain. And what they do is they basically recognize the amyloid plaques. I kind of compare them to like a flag that you put on the amyloid plaque, and the flag says, "Eat me," to the immune cells in the brain. These are cells that survey the brain for intruders. And when the flag is placed on the amyloid plaque that says, "Eat me," those immune cells come and basically eat or take away the amyloid beta. And you can reduce the amount of amyloid beta in the brain by, in fact, you reduce significantly the amount of amyloid beta in the brain by giving these medications. They
Does
do
that
it.
reverse the disease?
So, yeah, that's where the, what should I say? That's where it gets a little bit less exciting. So it does a great job of taking away the amyloid plaques from the brain, but there's a major disconnect between the removal of amyloid plaques and someone's benefit. So in about 70% of patients at the end of a year and a half of being on one of these drugs, you're completely, the amyloid plaques are completely gone.
Okay.
However, those patients only have their disease slow down by about 25 to 35%, depending on what clinical outcome you're looking at. So that means that they're not getting better, they're not staying the same, they're still going downhill, but just at a 25 to 35% slower rate than someone who's not on the drug. So again, there's a major disconnect between the very successful removal of amyloid plaques and the modest benefit of slowing the disease down by 25 to 35%. And what a lot of people have hypothesized is that the amyloid plaques are only maybe 25 to 35% of the equation Because that's the effect you're getting. You're getting 25 to 35% slowing of disease. Maybe amyloid plaques are only responsible for that amount, at least in that stage of the disease. And maybe there's other things that we're not going after that are continuing the disease progression. One easy one is the hyperphosphorylated tau. So that's the other component of Alzheimer's disease. There are drugs and clinical trials that are targeting hyperphosphorylated tau that have shown some promise, but they're still not clinically available yet. And then there's a whole host of other things beyond amyloid beta and hyperphosphorylated tau and Alzheimer's disease. We know that things like the mitochondria, which is sort of the power plant of the cell, we know that those start to fail. We know that the ability of the cells in the brain to what I call take out the garbage. Your cell will constantly accumulate garbage, and you need energy to be able to take it out and dispose of it. That process also fails, so you sort of get essentially too much garbage in the cell, and the cell can't work anymore. The ability of synapses to remodel and talk to each other gets damaged. There's a whole host of other things beyond amyloid and tau that happen, and that could be essentially self-sustaining. So even though we view amyloid beta in a lot of ways, and this is kind of a hotly debated area, but I think most people would agree that amyloid beta is problematic and definitely leads to further brain damage. So even though we know amyloid and tau define the disease, we are increasingly aware of these other processes that could take on a life of their own, basically, once they get started, that taking away amyloid beta might be kind of too late at that point and may only do or may only affect someone partially, such as what we're seeing with our current drugs. So those are the new medications that are currently available. I will kind of throw in there that we're really excited about newer, safer drugs that may not have, and I didn't mention this, but may not have brain bleeding or brain swelling. So that's one big problem of these anti-amyloid drugs is that by activating the immune system and revving up the immune system to take out those amyloid plaques, they sometimes kind of do collateral damage. And they can damage not only the brain, but the brain's blood vessels. Some of the amyloid beta goes into the blood vessels when the immune system attacks those blood vessel located amyloid areas. The collateral damage can actually rupture the blood vessel and then cause it to burst open and cause bleeding into the brain. So that's a main reason why my patients who decline to go on this medication, that's the reason they use. So there's newer drugs that look very promising that reduce that risk of brain bleeding and brain swelling hugely. And then, as I mentioned, there's other drugs on the near-term horizon that try to go after the disease before symptoms start. So I mentioned that there's many years and decades before those proteins actually cause symptoms. So right now, we're treating people, a long time after their disease has started. And some people have compared this to treating someone with stage four metastatic cancer, and your outcome is obviously going to be worse than if you treated them in stage one cancer, when they, let's say, using colon cancer, when you had a precancerous polyp in the colon, as opposed to treating colon cancer once it's metastasized all around your body. So a lot of people have argued that those drugs are more or less we're giving them too late. So, and there's some emerging evidence that it really could work well if we give these drugs to people in an earlier disease stage. There was a recent paper published looking at this in people who are guaranteed to get Alzheimer's. These are people who have an autosomal dominant mutation where you're guaranteed to get Alzheimer's in your mid-40s. Or at least, I'm sorry, the symptoms of Alzheimer's. I want to clarify that. And if you give those patients the drug for 8 years on average, you can prevent and this is before they reach that age, so 8 years before they reach their anticipated age of onset. You reduce the chances that they'll develop Alzheimer's by 50% at that age. So, and this was a drug that actually failed its phase three clinical trial in sort of run-of-the-mill Alzheimer's disease. So the drug actually is not maybe the best drug for treating that disease. So that gives us even more promise that if we use a really good drug like the drugs that are currently available, and we give it to people who have yet to develop these symptoms but still have the underlying proteins, we may turn Alzheimer's disease into a disease that, just like colon cancer, we can tackle when it's in a very incipient stage before it, ends up being a stage four disease. Maybe like colon cancer, again, not to overuse this analogy, everyone who turns age 50 may get tested with a blood test, and if you come back positive, you'll be enrolled in one of these therapies that takes away these abnormal proteins, so that maybe you'll never develop Alzheimer's disease. That's of course kind of the a very optimistic look on the future, but I think it's a very possible future from what we know from our science right now. So yeah, there's a lot of exciting treatments that are currently underway that are in phase three clinical trials. So we'll know the answer to these questions by about 2028 or 2029 when these phase three clinical trials read out.
That's exciting. That's exciting. So your work really, really, really relies on research, research, and more research. Leading organizations that support your efforts to find treatments and cures, what are some of those organizations and how do they help?
In my case, I was the very lucky recipient of the Katzman Award. And that was awarded when I was in fellowship at University of California, San Francisco. And that was thanks to the contributions from the American Brain Foundation, from the American Academy of Neurology, and the Alzheimer's Association. And it basically funded my science and also protected research time. So just to give you a context here, when you're a medical trainee, the salary you make is basically from your clinical revenue. So when you're a resident or a fellow, the programs you're with, they're paying for you by how much money, you're able to bring in by seeing patients, because patients are things that, you can bill to insurance companies. So these award, research unfortunately doesn't bring in any, money, at least not for a long time. There's that kind of growth phase where you need to set up your research team, set up a research project, eventually hopefully get more sustainable grant funding. But in that initial stage, which usually is at least a couple years, you need to find some way to do that research. And so that Katzman Award allowed me to basically have that seed funding and that runway to do research and really launch my career. Those are three organizations that I wanted to send a special thanks to.
What
Right
were
now,
they?
so the American Brain Foundation, the American Academy of Neurology, and the Alzheimer's Association, they kind of were the three funders of this Katzman Award that I was the lucky recipient of. There are other philanthropic organizations that I benefit from as the research kind of snowballed, and I was able to start thinking, okay, this is kind of what we need to do from a recruitment standpoint, and we need MRI scans, and as it kind of got bigger and bigger, and I was very fortunate to receive support from the Wallen Foundation, which is a family that is linked to Medtronic, the medical
Oh,
device company. And then the Fessler Lambert Foundation, which is a family that's Minnesota based. And that was after I arrived at University of Minnesota. And that basically extended my run. I'll call it the runway, because you're kind of like a plane waiting to take off. You can't take off if you've got, 10 feet in front of you. You need a couple hundred yards at least. And then so that kind of runway allowed me to get NIH funding. And I was, again, very lucky to have received what's called an R01 NIH grant, which is sort of the mainstay of how NIH funds scientific research. And that grant gives you, what should I say, that's when you're flying, so to speak. That's when you're up in the air and you're able to actually do full-scale scientific research. But it's absolutely true that I would never have gotten NIH grant if it weren't for the American Brain Foundation, those other donors, American Academy of Neurology, Alzheimer's Association, Wallen Philanthropies, and the Fessler Lambert Foundation, for, like, it gave me that long runway. So, and if you see other trainees who are like me, and we're all in the same boat, where you kind of need to, find ways to support that initial research career. One thing I'll say too, a lot of people ask me, well, why don't you just get NIH funding off the bat? And I'll say this much: NIH, they kind of want to know that what they're going to invest in is actually going to work. They don't want to give you, a couple million dollars to do all this research and then have it completely go up in smoke. They want to have you have a demonstrated track record of research. They want you to actually have good data that suggests that what you're going to do is actually true. The NIH grant, in some way, you kind of already know where the research is going to go. And so you need a good amount of preliminary data. So without these seed grants, again, there's no way to get to that level where you're actually doing the research. So yeah, it's something that I counsel residents and fellows on and encourage them to apply to, because it is kind of their, it's a lifeline. It really is their lifeline for getting a career in clinical research.
So, I appreciate you coming for this conversation, but there's more that I want to talk about. I'd like to get specific and talk about your research, the things that you're researching, because research matters a lot and research saves lives. So, I want to talk about the contributions that your specific research is making on curing brain diseases like dementia. Are you open to another conversation?
Yes, I'd be happy to.
Well, thank you. And again, congratulations on being associate professor. That's great.
Thank you. Yeah.
Right. So we will connect again. And thank you, Will. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. Be sure that you subscribe and share. You can get more leadership learning from my YouTube channel and by following me on Instagram. Reach out when you're looking for a speaker to energize your next event. Reach out when you need curated leadership learning for your organization. Reach out when you're ready for consulting that will help your organization fulfill its potential. I'm Joanne Smichel, and thank you for tuning in.